Today at Reader's Corner, David L. Roll, author of the new book, Ascent to Power, How Truman Emerged from Roosevelt's Shadow and Remade the World. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. When Roosevelt, in failing health, decided to run for a fourth term, he gave in to the big city Democrat bosses and reluctantly picked Senator Harry Truman as his vice president, a man he hardly knew. Upon FDR's death in April 1945, Truman, after only 82 days as VP, was thrust into the presidency. In his latest book, Ascent to Power, How Truman Emerged from Roosevelt's Shadow and Remade the World, David Roll focuses on these momentous years of transition, 1944 to 48, illuminating Truman's struggles to emerge as a president in his own right. David L. Roll is the author of George Marshall, and he is also the author of The Hopkins Touch. After serving as an assistant director in the Bureau of Competition at the FTC, he went on to practice law and founded Lex Mundi Pro Bono Foundation, a public interest organization that continues to provide pro bono legal services to social entrepreneurs around the world. David Roll, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is just a fine treatment of Harry Truman's very specific years from 44 to 48. I wonder if we could start in the epilogue of your book, of all places. I don't ordinarily do that, but you say in there that you're going to leave Truman's 1948 election and his full term until 52 for other historians and instead focus on that period from when he was thrust into the presidency upon FDR's death until 48. Tell us why. You can sum up what we're going to be talking about basically for the next half hour. What's going on here in those years that makes this such a critical moment in the United States and the world?
Let me just say that I did cover extensively the 48 election and the inauguration, but let me just back up. I think that the period between the time that he was thrust into the presidency in 1945 and then into the 48 election was the most consequential period in our recent history in terms of accomplishments and achievements in the world and domestically that we have ever seen, particularly what happened with our place in the world after World War II and the Marshall Plan, NATO, the Berlin Airlift, and civil rights at home. So I think that this period was just a rich period for the United States. And obviously, it was Truman's watch, and he accomplished an amazing amount in that short period.
Well, you know, I didn't get past the first page when I was reminded of how much I enjoy reading about Truman's life in two categories. One, the informality of the man, and secondly, the courage. But the informality, in your very introduction in this book to Harry, you tell the story of Truman driving home alone to his home in Independence, Missouri. I mean, it's 1944, and obviously it's a very different time. And by the way, we read a book here at Reader's Corner called Harry Truman's Excellent Adventure, The True Story of a Great American Road Trip, where Matthew Algio took us through this trip Bess and Harry took to New York and back. And that was after his retirement. But he is a guy that throughout his life, his professional life and career, he just seemed like an ordinary guy, didn't he?
Exactly. You know, and he took that trip, and he had a pre-war coupe, you know, and a Dodge coupe, I believe.
Yeah.
And back then, you know, in 1944, there were all kinds of regulations, things you could not get. And when he got to St. Louis, he's on his way to Independence to get ready for the convention in 1944.
Which is the other end of the state for those who might not be familiar with Missouri geography.
Right. So he goes to St. Louis, and he finds what he calls a tire man And tire man cut some corners and got Truman some tires that he basically needed. His tires were bald, and he got a couple of tires. But in the meantime, you know, he's an old Missouri guy, you know, and a common man, and he makes friends with the tire man. Never gave me the name of him. But he ended up taking the tire man to a restaurant that I think still exists in St. Louis for lunch with his political cronies. And, you know, he was that kind of guy. He was a man of the people. I always thought he was direct. He was sincere. You know, he didn't hide the ball. He was absolutely direct and authentic. I would say authentic.
That's a great word. Yeah.
Unlike President Roosevelt.
Yeah. He has the best lines using curse words of any president I've ever read.
Right.
He really knew how to throw them at the right time. So let me ask you a question that is key to this book. There's a jaw-dropping memo, as you call it, that was suppressed until 2007 regarding FDR's ability to serve a full term. Why don't you tell us that story and the extent to which FDR kept his Vice President Truman in the loop on domestic and especially foreign policy challenges?
Right. There was in between the doctors that some of them from Boston, from the Leahy Clinic, and some in Washington. He was told to his face on a Saturday that he would not survive a fourth term. We're talking about Roosevelt's fourth term. He was on Friday afternoon of a weekend, and I start the book on this weekend. On Friday afternoon, he decided that he was going to run for a fourth term. And so on Saturday, the doctors told him, if you do that, you're not going to survive. And one of them said to his face, you better be careful about choosing a vice president. And so on Sunday, the Secret Service men hauled him into a Lincoln limousine, and he was going to head up to what is today Camp David, but it used to be called Shangri-La under Roosevelt. And he went over to Q Street near Georgetown and picked up Lucy Mercer, and they spent a long, long day on that Sunday together up at the mountains where Camp David is today, and came back late that night. And then on Tuesday, he announced that he was running for a fourth term, having been told that he would not survive. And of course, Lucy, for those who may not know that he had a lover, Roosevelt was caught having an affair with Lucy Mercer back in 1918. Right after he got back from a trip to World War I, he said to his mother that his mother said, "I'll disinherit you if you ever see her again," and so he promised to never see her again. But of course, he did, and many, many, many times, and had her in the White House and so forth. And of course, he was in denial. I mean, he had to have understood what he was being told by expert doctors. And whether or not he and Lucy spoke about his decision to run, despite what the doctors had told him, we'll never know. But some historians have said that Lucy actually said, you ought to go ahead and run, even though the risk was so great.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is David L. Roll, author of the new book, Ascent to Power. So you mentioned the doctor warning Roosevelt that he better be very careful and judicious about his vice presidential appointment. Harry Truman at the time, serving in the U.S. Senate, was not exactly the one name that everyone would recognize as, oh yeah, he should succeed Roosevelt. Right. I grew up an old St. Louis Cardinal fan, and I was delighted to hear that baseball got into this decision because it was Bob Hannigan, the St. Louis Cardinal owner, who apparently had something to do with making this happen. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So, yeah, Hannigan was a St. Louis guy that helped Truman when he was running for Senate with those St. Louis voters and a couple of precincts or whatever you call them, then the wards, I guess, in St. Louis. He delivered votes for Truman when he was a senator. Truman had two terms as senator before he became vice president. But, you know, Truman owed a debt to Hannigan. And somehow, when Truman was a senator, he became somewhat well-known because of his investigation of the defense industry during the war when he was a senator. But he had a little bit of influence, and he somehow got Hannigan appointed the head of the Internal Revenue Service, of all things. Now, Hannigan was a lawyer. I suppose he knew a little bit about taxes. And so he got Hannigan to Washington. And he also, Hannigan one day called him up and said, you know, they want me to be the head of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. And he said, I don't know whether I want to do that or not. And he said, should I do it? And Truman said, yeah, you should do it. He said, but I'll tell you one thing, don't agree to it unless Roosevelt says it directly to your face. And so one day Hannigan called up Truman and said, well, he did it. He said it right to my face and I took it. And so Truman began his presidency with the head of the DNC behind him. So that was a terrific coincidence that he got this guy from St. Louis into Washington. And the big city Democratic bosses really wanted Truman. Let me just back up a bit. Roosevelt decided in 1944 to promise two individuals the vice presidency. Neither of them was Truman, but he reneged. He reneged on his promises to those two people. One of them was Henry Wallace, who was the current vice president. Another one was Jimmy Burns, who was actually highly qualified. And he was kind of the assistant, he was called the assistant president. Anyway, Roosevelt stabbed him in the back. He reneged on both of those promises, and he gave in with some reluctance to the big city Democratic bosses who, responding to Hannigan, felt that Truman would do the less harm, the least harm to the ticket under Roosevelt in 1944. And so Roosevelt offered the vice presidency to Truman from his train 2,000 miles to the west through a radio hookup on the first day of the convention. And Truman was in the room when Roosevelt said, I want you. So it wasn't quite face-to-face, but it was a direct offer to be the vice president. And Truman had told his wife and everybody else that would listen that he would never accept the vice presidency. Said he didn't want it, but when Roosevelt asked him from the radio hookup, Truman accepted. And his wife was outraged. She was, for a lot of reasons, which I could explain, but she did not want to be vice president, much less president. But he's a political guy, you know, and his lust for power overtook his relationship with his wife, Bess. His wife was a key figure, of course, in Truman's life.
Yeah.
And she had a great hold over him, and he adored her.
Tell us about Truman's special message on civil rights. You have a statement in which he talks about believing in the brotherhood of man and giving the Negroes, the term that was used then, the rights which are theirs. We are only acting in accord with our own ideals of a true democracy. This is the 1940s, and the state of Missouri. I don't think the state of Missouri today would have any use for Truman for saying that, given how conservative Missouri has become. But man, I mean, in the 1940s, this is a guy who was sticking his neck out.
Yeah, that was the speech. That speech, the Brotherhood of Man speech, was in Sedalia. You probably know where that is.
Oh, I sure do. It is so rural and so out state, as we used to call areas that are rural and, you know, kind of out of it. Sedalia is down
there. It was a sundown. Back then, they had sundown cities or villages or towns. They would not let Negroes into the town after sundown. This was one of those places. And that's when he first gave his a breakthrough, Brotherhood of Man speech. But leading up to that, you have to understand that Truman's two sets of grandparents enslaved African Americans. His mother, Truman's mother, would not sleep in the Lincoln room, Lincoln suite, when she came to visit her son in the White House. Truman was not exactly, the first person you would think about civil rights, particularly in, you know, Missouri was a racist place in the early 40s. But by the mid-1947, his views had really evolved. And that's when it was in the spring of 1947, when a guy named Walter White, who was head of the NAACP, was in Truman's office. And he said to Truman, I suggest that the time is right for you to deliver a major speech on civil rights. The time is right. And that you would be the first president to do so since Lincoln. And so on a Sunday in early June of 1947, on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, Truman, and with the Howard University chorus behind him, singing Lift Every Voice, Truman held forth to a crowd of 10,000 NAACP supporters and their friends. And he said at the outset, I'm trying to remember exactly how he said it, but he said, I am deeply convinced that this nation has reached a turning point in its efforts to guarantee freedom and equality to all Americans. And then he said, and when I say all Americans, I mean all Americans. And then he went on to tick off his program for civil rights and, you know, touching bases with voting rights, fair trials, and all those things, housing, medical care. And that was the first step, really, as a president. That he made in his crusade for civil rights, which he continued to advocate until the Southerners realized that unlike Roosevelt, Truman was really serious about civil rights, and so they 12 states left the Democratic Party and formed a states' rights party, otherwise known as the Dixiecrats. This was on the eve of the 1948 presidential election. So Truman, of course, and his advisors knew that they were going to lose a lot of votes, and they had to orchestrate a massive turnout by the black vote in the United States in order to offset the loss of the South. And that's what they did. There's a whole story about the African Americans that worked on his campaign and, were mostly ignored by Truman biographers.
Right. Today I'm speaking with David L. Roll, author of the new book, Ascent to Power. The book focuses on the fascinating story behind the most consequential presidential transition in U.S. history, from Roosevelt to Truman. Let's talk about the Potsdam Conference, when the criticism was that Truman wasn't tough enough on Stalin, and as a result of that, Eastern European countries were given away. You in your book explain what may account for that. Secondly, of course, the decision to detonate two atomic bombs over two Japanese cities. It's going to be debated till the end of time. But both of these seem to be related a bit to how Truman regarded his original vice presidency to FDR and FDR's policies, if I understand your book correctly.
Right. Yeah. You know, and he, you know, I say in the book, you know, let's talk about the bomb for a minute. You know, at Potsdam, that's when Truman learned that the atomic bomb would work, and that there were going to be two atomic bombs available for potential use over over Japan, and all of the advisors to Roosevelt and all of the and all the people that directed the Manhattan Project, they assumed that Roosevelt, if he still lived, would have deployed the bomb over Japan. A lot of them were actually, you know, working for Truman after Roosevelt died, and so Truman regarded FDR's legacy. He believed that FDR would have done it, and for that reason, he should do it. And I think that was, he believed it was part of Roosevelt's legacy, an unspoken bequest to his successor, Truman. And I think that General Leslie Groves, the head of the Manhattan Project, said it the best way about the decision to drop the bomb. You know, Roosevelt never actually made an explicit decision to drop either the bomb, the first bomb. And and what Leslie Groves said is that if it was a decision, it was a decision to not intervene or not to upset existing plans. So Truman could have said no, and that would have been a decision, but he didn't. And as a result, you know, they went ahead with the dropping of the atomic bomb. Now, he was criticized not just for allowing one bomb to be dropped, and that's what he did. He allowed it. He allowed one bomb to drop. But the second bomb, the two atomic bombs, and he was criticized then, he's criticized now, and probably criticized forever. He took full responsibility for it. And he never looked back. And you remember that scene in the book, or the movie about, the recent movie about, what's his name? The guy that was behind the atomic bomb.
Oh, yeah. Oppenheimer.
Yeah, you know.
Oppenheimer,
right, yeah. Right.
Well, let me focus on one last thing here, because I think we've got time for a really solid answer on this one. I can think of three instances in your book, and there's probably a lot more than that, where Truman overrides the experts or overrides the political people. His decision to confer legitimacy on the new state of Israel was opposed by the Secretary of State, Marshall, who you're the ultimate expert on Marshall, having written the bio. His State Department and the military brass, they were all opposed to it. Then in July of 1948, he decides to reinstitute the draft. This is months before his election. And right, it's like, right. Hey, that's kind of a controversial thing to do, and moms and dads aren't going to like that. And then the Berlin airlift. Right. He overrules the Joint Chiefs of Staff to pull off what was a most successful Berlin airlift. I mean, please comment, but I mean, this is a guy who made the tough decisions. They weren't always the right ones, according to folks who have measured him as a president. But gosh, I don't know where you find that kind of courage these days.
I think, you know, yeah, the Berlin airlift, you know, the Joint Chiefs were clutching their pearls about whether this is going to work and what's going to happen and why, you know, we can't possibly supply the Berliners through the winter by just flying, you know, these cargo planes. And you know, they wanted to save some of these planes for use elsewhere in case there's some other problem in the rest of the world. And Truman just nailed it. He just said, no, we're giving them everything. And you know what? He overruled them. And I think his stance on the Berlin airlift was amazing because again, he was up against a lot of resistance and a lot of second guessers. The recognition of Israel was, you know, dramatic. It was, It was, you know, it took his friend Eddie Jacobson, who he was in business with in Kansas City, managed to get people and Chaim Weizmann into the White House to talk to Truman about recognizing Israel. And Marshall was dead set against it because he was trying to negotiate a truce. He didn't want an immediate recognition. He thought the Jews would lose. Marshall, the big military man, thought the Jews would lose, but they got a cache of weapons and from the Czechs that I guess Marshall didn't know about. So Truman in the end he wavered at times, but in the end he went through with the recognition of Israel and took the heat from Marshall and the entire State Department. Eleanor Roosevelt was against what Truman did, but we became the first nation to do it, and we've been committed to Israel ever since.
So I wonder if we could talk for a moment about Henry Wallace and the Progressive Party. And the only reason I want to talk about this is that this is a little tidbit of history I missed in my American history course in college. And so it's 1948. Truman's running for president. Henry Wallace, who was Roosevelt's VP, isn't that correct?
Yes.
But is now a candidate for president under the Progressive Party label,
Right. Very
liberal. And at one point, Truman's aides say, it's time to take this guy on. And Truman does so. Where and who introduces him at the event and who's at the head table? Boy, this is a collection of very important people.
Ronald Reagan,
the eventual Republican, but then still the Democrat, I guess, right?
Oh, yeah. He really went after Wallace. He didn't use his name hardly at all during the 48 whistle stop campaign. But you know, Wallace was attracting communists. The Communist Party in Washington, America, were behind him, and he accepted all the votes he could get from, or all the voters that he could get from the communists. But one just little sort of what if kind of thing. Roosevelt's eldest daughter, her name was Anna Roosevelt Bodiger. She was his caregiver. Beginning in 1944, when Harry Hopkins left the White House, and she moved into the White House and became Roosevelt's caregiver. She was responsible for extending Roosevelt's life by at least a year. If it hadn't been for her, Roosevelt would have died in 1944 or before the inauguration January 20th, 1945. And who would have been president? Wallace. She actually, extended his life. And if Wallace had been president, it would have been an entirely different world.
And there's a new book out on that. If anybody's interested, all they have to do is Google Wallace and the vice presidency.
Right.
I can't remember the name of the book. But anyway, it's been a delight having you on the show, David. And I want to once again make sure everyone knows what we're talking about here. This is really well done. Ascent to Power, How Truman Emerged from Roosevelt's Shadow and Remade the World. David Roll is the author, and he's the guy we've been talking to. I highly recommend this book. David, so nice of a job. Thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner, and thanks for writing the book.
Thank you for having me.
Take care now.
All right. Take care.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio and News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
new from The Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.